I live just down the road in Prestbury. We thought we wouldn't bring Jacob with all his little calomel spots. He's covered in white and red splodges at the moment, but it is great to be with you. I was really excited when I heard that you're in a series called Better and Best, thinking through what does it mean for us to thrive? What does it mean for us to flourish? And as a life coach, that's something I think a lot about. And I find I am a life coach, but I struggle sometimes with that term. And the reason I struggle with it is I think a lot of life coaching can be seen as you follow your dreams, you get those goals, you whatever's in your heart, you pursue it, and this will help you get there. And whilst I'm a big believer in dreams and goals, I think there's a big difference between being the best version of yourself so that you can bring the best to your family, so you can bring the best to your friendships, to your workplace, to your church, to your ministry, so that we see the transformation of life, so we fulfill God's dreams, God's agenda. And so it's being at our best for transformation, for God's work, as opposed to, and get very my dreams, can't it, and my goals, and very inward looking. And so my heart, in all that I do, whether that's life coaching, whether that's one-to-one, or what I'm working out individually in my faith, in my life, is we say, Lord, what are you doing? How can I be at my best mentally, physically, spiritually, emotionally, so that wherever I'm operating, I'm giving all that God's put in me and all he's calling me to that situation. And when I meet with people, one of the themes I often see coming up, and I see it in my own life, is around how fear can get in the way of that. How fear can get in the way of us being at our best. You know, it stops us from doing things. And we live in a world, I think, that can be controlled by fear. You know, we have this, whether it's the news cycle coming at us 24/7, I think we just know a lot more what's going on in our world. And often that's some of the negative stuff that we get reported. Whether it's, you know, the politics at the moment, the narrative of fear that comes through that with Brexit, what's going to happen? I think advertising tries to play on our fear of what if you don't buy this product, if you don't vote for this party, if you don't make this choice, then X might happen. And it's playing on that. It tries to press, I think, on our fear. And some of us would admit maybe we're more naturally prone to fear. Maybe some of us would say, yeah, I'm a bit of a worrier, or we've grown up in families where there's, you know, more of a cautious kind of way of doing things, and we've grown up a little bit fearful. That's an environment where fear would more naturally be part of that. And some of us have had situations that have made us feel more fearful, of to more quickly jump to what the worst could be. But I think sometimes we label some people struggle with fear, but some of us don't. And I think if we're really honest, I think we all struggle with fear. It just looks different. And that's a bit what I want to share about today, the subtlety of fear. I think it looks different. It looks different to me, to my husband Gareth, to what it might do in your life, but it's still there. And I guess I'll start with me. I'll be honest about what it looks like in my life. I like to fix things. I like to take action. I don't know if you're into Myers-Briggs. I do Myers-Briggs a bit in my job, and I'm a J on Myers-Briggs. And I like decisions. I like actions. I like to solve things. So I can be a bit of a fixer. And what I find when I can't fix things, which happens regularly, then I can start to feel this fear. And that can come up in loads of situations. And I found out most recently, in the past sort of 3 years or so, it's happened with my health. So I have been blessed with incredible health most of my life, and still am to a high degree. But about 5 years ago, suddenly one night, I came down extremely ill with viral meningitis. So right as rain during the day, and then suddenly at night, very excruciating pain. And went to hospital, did lots of tests, and that's where they diagnosed the viral meningitis. And was pretty extremely ill for about 2 weeks with a lot of pain. And then for the year after, I was kind of recovering. It hits the immune system pretty hard, and it was fatigue and phased return to work and all that kind of stuff. And we did adjustments, and life was, after about a year, most of the symptoms had thankfully gone. But after a short while, I found that it really hit my immune system harder than we thought. And ever since then, I pick up just about every bug or flu or thing that there is, and I kind of get sent to bed for a couple of weeks. In the winter period, it's about once a month I'll catch something. And Jacob is at nursery often, and he's normally constantly got a cold or a sniffle. The families over here might resonate with that. And so he's like a little carrier of germs, bless him. We don't call him that. But there's constantly a cold or a sniffle or a cough in our house. And I pick it up, and then my body just runs with it. So I'm often in bed with those things. And that has felt deeply frustrating at times, mainly because I'm like, I can't solve this one. And I'm a believer in do what you can do in a situation. So I've upped my healthy eating, and I've tried to exercise more, and, you know, just be really careful. I've got vitamins, and I, you know, try and reduce your stress. You do all the things you can do. That's what we often do in situations. But I realized, whether it's health or lots of other situations we can think about, we come to a point in our lives where we realize we face so many things, we can't fix them, can we? We can't solve them in our own strength. We run out. And I don't know if you, at that point, when I've done all my stuff, and I'm not saying this is a good strategy at all, then my little fear starts to drive. What if? Don't you get the what if starts to swirl around? What if I'm being referred to an immunologist at the moment? What if he doesn't find anything out? What if he does find something out? And that is even worse, that I know something that I didn't want to know. Or what if we can't solve this? What if I constantly am getting ill and we're missing special events and anniversaries and weddings and precious things? And what if my son remembers me as a sick, kind of often in bed mum? And so the cycle of fear rises. It's like a narrative. And one of the things I've realized is, if you were talking to me, if you saw me, you wouldn't know. You wouldn't say, oh, Zoe's worried about her health, hopefully. Even my husband Gareth might not say Zoe worries about this or talks about this all the time. But I think, well, the more I've reflected on this and looked at my life, at different things that might be going on, it's like this noise in the background, a little kind of a distraction of what fear does. It's very subtle. It's like this kind of humming of things that we'd use the phrase, I've got this on my mind. I'm kind of murmuring, dwelling on it, thinking about it. And that's what I think is the danger, whether it's just that situation or we've all got often one or more things that we're thinking about that aren't ideal. Maybe it's someone in our family, a friend's going through, and they accumulate. And I think they create what I'd call this background noise. And I think it tires us. I think it distracts us. I think it makes us, you know, concerned. It robs us of energy. And it's kind of there. And sometimes it gets louder as a situation might get more pressing, and sometimes it goes back. But it's there in the background affecting me, bringing my best to family life, to church life, doing different things. And I wonder if you feel the same, that there are situations in your life where you know there's something that's kind of on your mind, that we sometimes use the language again of, I'm concerned about, don't we? I'm concerned about this situation. I don't know what it is for you, where that soundtrack of fear might be playing or just slightly rising at the moment. You know, sometimes it's if you have children, you know, will they get into the right university, or they're about to make a huge decision and you have no idea which way they're going to go, and you know which way you'd like them to go maybe, but you have no control about what they do, and you're worried about them because you love them. Maybe it's elderly parents that are unwell and you're caring for them and you can't be there as often as you would like, but they're on your mind, aren't they? You're thinking, could I do more, or could we get there more often? Or you ring them and the diagnosis is not good and they're getting worse, not better, and it's there, isn't it, playing in the background. Maybe it's your career. Maybe there have been some difficult decisions or conversations at work, and they're just weighing on you, and it's this noise. You might not be worrying about them overtly, but they're there in the background. And I think that is what makes fear so dangerous. It just bubbles along. And I've heard lots of, you might as well, I've heard lots of talks about fear and faith. I think often they're kind of pitched to us as opposite. We either live in a place of fear or we live in a place of faith. And we need to choose one or the other. And I think the danger is then that we focus on how we eliminate fear. So we sit here and we think, I've got to stop being fearful. And we end up zooming in on fear rather than zooming in on faith. And I think it isn't either or. I think God knows that we feel fear initially. We're designed, aren't we? We've been designed to feel fear if we're near a sudden danger. Fear is a natural part of life. But I don't think God wants us to stay there. I don't think he wants to live afraid. I don't think he wants us to walk out each day living with fear, murmuring in the background. And if we're going to follow Jesus, we know that in the kingdom we're going to get called into loads of situations that are more naturally going to call us, you know, to be afraid. We're called to take risks, aren't we? We're called to push boundaries. We're called to do new things, to move homes, to take new jobs, to do different things that are countercultural. We should be living a life that might naturally cause one to live on the edge of fear versus faith. And so I just want to say, I don't think we're talking about eliminating fear. I think we're talking about not living with fear, not having that mindset of fear. And I want to just read a passage this morning. I think it's going to come up on the screens behind me. It's Matthew 14, 22 to 33. It's quite a well-known passage. It's where Jesus walks on the water. I just want to pull out some truths for us around this morning. Verse 22, immediately after this, Jesus had just fed the 5,000, that well-known miracle with 5 loaves and 2 fishes. And it says, immediately after this, Jesus insisted that his disciples get back into the boat and cross to the other side of the lake while he sent the people home. After sending them home, he went up into the hills by himself to pray. Night fell while he was there alone. Meanwhile, the disciples were in trouble far away from land. A strong wind had risen and they were fighting heavy waves. About 3 o'clock in the morning, Jesus came towards them walking on the water. When the disciples saw him walking on the water, they were terrified. In their fear, they cried out, "It's a ghost!" But Jesus spoke to them at once. "Don't be afraid," he said. "Take courage, I am here." Then Peter called to him, "Lord, if it's really you, tell me to come to you walking on the water." "Yes, come," Jesus said. So Peter went over the side of the boat and he walked on the water towards Jesus. But when he saw the wind and the waves, he was terrified. And he began to sink. "Save me, Lord," he shouted. Jesus immediately reached out and grabbed him. "You have so little faith," Jesus said. "Why did you doubt me?" When they climbed back into the boat, the wind stopped. Then the disciples worshipped him. "You really are the Son of God," they exclaimed. And I guess a bit of context around that. So Jesus has just fed the 5,000. And then just after what I've just read, when he gets to the other side of the lake with the disciples, we see Jesus healing lots of people of sickness. And what I love about the disciples, it kind of reassures me. Do you have that when you can have real moments of you see God do a miracle? You know, maybe you're a gathering and, you know, someone gets healed or there's an incredible prophetic word that God might speak into your life and you think, and you have this kind of spiritual, God is amazing, he is alive, he can do anything. I'm full of faith for every situation I'm facing in my life right now. And then the next day, they're in the boat, they're terrified. And I can be a bit like that. Like, yeah, God, you're amazing. And then suddenly the next day I got a call and I can feel that fear start to rise. That's being human, isn't it? You know, and then, you know, they're real like us. And so I just want to pull out a few things that I think in this passage we see fear doing to the disciples and I think it does to us. I think the first thing that fear does is it affects how we see things. It affects our vision. In verse 26, it says, when the disciples saw him walking on the waters as Jesus, they were terrified. In their fear, they cried out, "It's a ghost." Their fear causes them to panic. And you know what's like when you get into a panic situation? You don't see things. You just misread everything. They've spent loads of time with Jesus. They know exactly what he looks like. And yet when he's coming towards them on the water, they don't recognize him at all. They think it's a ghost. And I think fear affects how we see things. It distorts, it enlarges, it exaggerates. You know, the other night, Jacob woke up in the night. He's like, Mummy, there's a monster in my room. You know, it's classic kind of children. And, you know, there's not a monster, darling, in your room. You know, it's like, but they see, we, especially in the dark, we sometimes see things that aren't really there. And I think we do that with fear. Fear prevents us from seeing anything as it actually is. Forgive me, my pages are sticking together. And I think if we're not careful, it goes from being that momentary, I'm not seeing this quite as it is, to it can actually become the lens with which we view the world. It's like we're wearing a pair of fear glasses and we don't take them off. And every small situation or big one, the fear starts to rise. Because what if that happens? What if the worst happens? What if they don't call back? What if I don't get the job? And it starts to kind of crank up. You know, maybe you've had a situation at work where you haven't had your finest moment, you made a mistake, and you know your boss doesn't think it's great, you know your colleagues don't think it's great, and you find yourself when you lay your head on the pillow at night, and it's there, isn't it, rumbling of, oh, I've got to have that conversation, and I've got to face that tomorrow, it's there. We're waiting, you know, for our children to navigate situations, like I said. We're waiting for some test results, and it's there, isn't it? Our fear shifts how we see that situation. And I think it's natural that we would feel fearful when we're waiting for test results or worried about a loved one. It's natural that we, like I said, feel fear, but when we dwell on what could happen, we live in fear. And I think fear not only alters what we see, it alters what we say. It shifts our language. You know, I think often this can be spoken over us. Maybe you've got friends or family that are a bit more on the fearful side of things. And it's the language of, maybe you're discussing a big decision you're about to make with your parents, for example. And they start to go, oh, but what if? You know, sometimes my mom will do that, but what if, Zoe? Or are you sure? And it's different language. Rather than speaking faith into someone, it's fearful language, isn't it? We speak that. And last year, Gareth, my husband, and I faced a really complex and messy, difficult situation in our church, and I was just kind of in this fog of what do we do, what's the right decision, and who do you talk to? And I remember a really wise friend, she was listening to me kind of vomit all my thoughts and concerns, and she just looked at me and she said, what is fear and what is the Father? What is the Father saying to you? What's fear? What's truth was what she was saying. She's like, fear's going to throw a whole load of lies at you. You're going to see things as they're not. You're going to see people's intentions as they're not. She said, what is the Spirit saying to you? What's truth? And we see in verse 27, Jesus speaks to them when they're panicking and freaking out. He says, don't be afraid. Take courage. I am here. And his voice cuts through the noise and the fear and the panic and the kind of fog in our head that we get. And it brings calm. In your life right now, with all that you've got going, we all have stuff going on. Life is like that, isn't it? Where is fear speaking? Where's the voice of fear rising and lying and exaggerating in your life and affecting the way that you perceive that situation? And what's Jesus saying? What's truth? What's the truth that he wants to speak into that cuts through all the fear and all of the noise? I think the second thing that fear does is it causes us to doubt God and his goodness, and it causes us to doubt what he said to us. We see in verse 28, Peter calls to Jesus and he said, Lord, if it's really you, tell me to come to you walking on the water. And then Peter sees the wind and the waves and he's terrified and he sinks. And then Jesus looks at him and says, why did you doubt me? Why did you doubt me? And I think fear, we start with fear and then very quickly it's followed by doubt. And those what ifs. We start with a, oh no, and then like, oh, you know, and we doubt God, we forget his goodness. And it's like we're so in the situation, we forget God's entire track record of love and of faithfulness and of doing the impossible and turning it. We're so in it, aren't we? We, like I said, the feeding of the 5,000, and the next minute, oh my goodness, the world is ending. I'm caught in panic and I'm caught in fear. And right at the start of the Bible, in Genesis 3, we see this doubt being sown in. The serpent asks Eve, did God really say that you must not eat the fruit from any of the trees in the garden? Like, did God really say that? And isn't that what happens in our lives now? Doesn't the enemy do that? Did God really say you should give up your job and do something different? Did God really say you should speak to that person? Did God really heal you, or did you just get better? You know, when you're having that reflective time on your own with the Lord, did you really hear him? Or was it just your idea that you came up with? Which is it? And it's the voice of doubt. And at the time, you were confident and you knew you'd heard the Lord. And you maybe, I'm going to write it down in my journal kind of person. You know, when you wrote it down, you knew, when you spoke to your friend, you knew you'd heard the Lord. You knew he'd healed you. But then time passes and fear rises and that voice of doubt is there. Did God really say, never will I leave you or forsake you? And all the truth and all that you knew and know really well can go in a second if we're not careful. Ephesians 6:12 says this, for we're not fighting against flesh and blood enemies, but against evil rulers and authorities of the unseen world, against mighty powers in this dark world, against evil spirits in the heavenly realms. Our battle is with an enemy who loves to sow fear and doubt. Jesus calls him the father of lies, and he loves to do that. He loves to play the what-if card in your situations. Where today has fear caused you to doubt, to forget the goodness of God, his deep, deep love for you? You know, he sent his son to die for us on the cross. He would do anything. He loves us. He's the God that, you know, parted the Red Sea, that fed the 5,000. Where is fear causing you to question or forget his kindness and his goodness and his power in your life? And I think the third area where fear can really affect us is it causes us to focus on the situation rather than focus on God. It causes us to zoom in and get really kind of narrow. It says, when Peter saw the strong wind and the waves, he was terrified and he began to sink. You know, we focus, don't we, maybe on the argument and the words that were said, and they're going around and, you know, she said this and he said that, we misread intention, don't we? We hear the hurtful words rather than God's grace over that person and seeing them as God sees them. We focus on the lump that we found or the poor diagnosis naturally rather than God's power to heal. We focus on our dwindling bank balance that isn't quite as we would like it to be, rather than God's ability to provide and his track record of the times that money maybe has got pushed through the envelope or a friend has showed up with money for us. We focus on the bad feedback maybe either from a friend or a work situation, and we hear that over who we are rather than God says who we are, about our identity. And so we zoom in, don't we? I like that. I just zoom in on the problem and I talk about it, I think about it. When I was training as a coach, they had this phrase that they just kept saying again. So what you focus on is what will develop. You know, so most people come to coaching because they're stuck and they want change and they haven't been able to get that change by themselves. And so they sit in front of you and you say, what do you want to talk about? And they will share the problem, the situation they're stuck with. And, you obviously ask a few questions. Coaching's very question-based. But if you keep talking about the problem, your client focuses further on the problem and leaves having talked about the problem, and they probably didn't really need that. They could have chatted with their friend about that. You focus on what, on possibility with the client. You focus on their gifts and their strengths and their abilities to cope with that situation. But what could you do? What's a different way of looking at this situation? And I think that's true in our lives. What we focus on is what develops and grows. So if we focus on fear, if we focus on the situation, it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And it's still all we can see and all we can think about. In psychologists, they call this ruminating. And it's when we dwell on negative thoughts. And they say when something bad happens, it's natural that you would feel a bit of fear or you would think about it. That's natural, that's human, and that's normal. But they say when it gets dangerous is when you dwell on it and you think about it again and again and again. That's ruminating. And they would use a word as strong as toxic. They would say that actually ruminating is one of the key drivers of depression. You dwell and dwell and dwell until, you can't see lies from truth, realities has gone. Hebrews 12 says this, and let us run with endurance the race God has set before us. How do we do that? We do this by keeping our eyes on Jesus, the champion who initiates and perfects our faith. And 2 Corinthians 4:18, so we fix our eyes not on what is seen, but on what is unseen. What is seen is temporary, and what is unseen is eternal. And I feel like so often God wants to just really lovingly come around in all the situations of facing and kind of just gently lift our chins up. Go, look up, look up, look at me. Remember who I am. Remember our relationship together. Remember my track record. Remember, focus on my goodness. Focus on my character. Focus on my track record, not on yours. And I think, I don't know about you, but I think I see around and I see in my life, I think we are exhausted from what the noise of fear brings to our life. It takes so much. The what ifs, the dwelling on the difficult situation, the letting fear exaggerate to us. It's taking a lot, and it's taking a lot from the kingdom. I think we're exhausted from carrying burdens we were never meant to bear. And I would say when I, you know, tell my, someone says to you, every now and then they do, tell me about how you became a Christian. I would have my story of, oh, I became a Christian when I was 14, and off I'd go on my story. And I was reflecting maybe about 18 months ago, you know, because again, the language you'd often use when we become a Christian is, you know, I invited Jesus into my life and I asked him to take charge. And I reflected, I've been a Christian a long time. And I thought, my goodness, have I really ever let him take charge? Is he really on the throne? You know, a little misfix here. I was like, has he really been in charge? Or have I just given him a few things that I'd like him to look after that I'm comfortable really to let go with? You can be Lord there, but this stuff, I'm just going to fix it. I'm going to sort it. I'm going to worry about it when I can't sort it. And I've got this pile of stuff that I've just looked after at different times, and I pick stuff up, and some stuff works. We can live on our own strength, abilities, resources, intelligence. We can do that. Lots of people do that around us, don't they? And then I read this quote that stopped me in my tracks. It's by a guy called Robert Mulholland. He's a theologian. And he said, there are two fundamental ways of being human in this world. Trusting your own human resources and abilities, or a radical trust in God. And I just sat there and I felt like I'd been hit with something. I was like, that's me? I have lived most of my Christian life doing that. And I didn't even know it. I knew I liked to be, you know, like things to be organized or to feel in control, don't we all? But I didn't realize how serious it was. I didn't realize it. We can live one way or the other. My friend looked me in the eye, and in a helpful way, she's like, "So either he's God or he's not." And I was like, "Oh my goodness!" And I would genuinely say, maybe 18 months ago, I became a Christian again, or maybe properly for the first time. And I just went, "Let it go." I've had the Frozen song, "Let It Go," running around in my head. I won't sing it to you, but it is that, you know. In every situation, it's like, "Let it go." Don't try and hold it, control it. I mean, goodness, most of us know, don't we? Life is not a simple walk in the park. There are great seasons and there are harder ones. It is up and it's down. And any of us that think we're in control at some point soon realize we're not, whether it's health, whether it's work, whether it's money, whether it's love, we are not in control of these situations. And when we live on the throne trying to be, it's just hard. And we don't live fully in all of the arenas of our lives. Verse 32, at the end of the passages, it says, when they climbed back into the boat, the wind stopped. Then the disciples worshipped him. And I love this. You really are the Son of God, they exclaimed. Like, yeah, he just fed 5,000 people. But yes, he really is the Son of God. And isn't that what we do? I think that's what I felt like 18 months ago. I was like, oh my goodness, you really are the Son of God. And that means that changes everything. Changes everything. Nothing should look the same, should feel the same. We should live so differently when we really, really get it. And I don't think I really, really got it, maybe. I have to confess, I haven't told many people this, but I'm telling all of you 18 months ago. There's another way to live. And what situation in your life do you just want to maybe just today, just put it down and say, you really are. Let him, you know, just give him space to move in your life. Just watch what he does. Because I find the more I let go, I think the older I get, the more I realize it's all really about surrender. I listen to lots of talks and I read lots of books, but I think a lot of it just comes down to letting go and surrender and just popping it all on the floor at the foot of the cross and going, you can have it all. You can have it. I think it's a song. You can have, got to go in my head. You can have it all, Lord. You can have it all. Can he? Can he have it all? And then we see, and then he moves, doesn't he? He provides, or he whispers, or he nudges open doors. And we go, oh, you really are. You really are the Son of God. And I don't want to live the old way anymore, because you don't see all the incredible stuff, because you're sorting it out all yourself. Whereas when you let go and you lay it down, you have those precious moments of, oh, you provided, you answered, you came through, you are the Son of God. And so as I come into land, when you find yourself, whatever you're in now, right now, there's probably something on your mind maybe, or what you go home to this afternoon and tonight. In fact, can you just close your eyes for me? And I don't know what you came in carrying, thinking about, mulling on, let's call it that. And when you find yourself thinking about it this week, this afternoon, I would just love to ask you to say to yourself, what would radical trust in God in this situation that's going around in my head look like? Have I been trying to rely on my own human resources or abilities? What would radical trust look like with your health, with your mum and dad, with your children, with your friend who's in hospital at the moment, with your bank balance, with your career, with your marriage, with your singleness, whatever it is? What would radical, what would complete and utter abandon and let it all go look like?